Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I think Paul and these earliest followers of Jesus, they believed in that kind of physical resurrection. So when they say Jesus rose from the dead, they mean he bodily rose from the dead.
I grew up with Jesus lives in my heart, and I like that. And I don't like the notion that he's in outer space, 5,000 miles away, and maybe I'll get to see him someday. That's just weird. That's weird.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome along to the show. Looking forward to introducing my guests, Justin Bass and Dale Allison, for today's Easter weekend edition of the show. And a very happy Easter to you, wherever you're listening from. Just a reminder that we have a new mini-site to explore all our shows from Premier Unbelievable. You can also register for our newsletter, get a free ebook from William Lane Craig, and you can support us too. All available at premierunbelievable.com. And just before we jump into today's show, I just want to let you know that the Unbelievable Conference, only 4 weeks away now. Are you going to be with us? We've published our seminar schedule. You can find out all about it at the booking page, unbelievable.live. We're going to be in the wonderful, beautiful auditorium at the British Library in London. That's where you'll be if you come in person. We've got it catered for you as well across the course of the afternoon and the evening. Refreshments and everything are all included in your ticket price, but you'll have a wonderful time if you attend remotely as well from anywhere in the world, especially in the US and Canada. We've done it at 2 p.m. UK, which is 9 a.m. Eastern. Hopefully a good time for people to attend from all over the place. And as I mentioned last week, Horizon College and Seminary in Saskatoon, Canada are putting on a live screening of the day. If you're in that part of the world and would like to join in live there, well then do go along to their website and you can book in that way. But you can book in from anywhere in the world at unbelievable.live. See all the seminars, see all the speakers. Do come along in person or online. We'd love to have you with us on Saturday, the 14th of May. Right now, time to get into today's conversation. Well, today we're asking, does the historical evidence support the physical resurrection of Jesus? Two New Testament scholars, Dale Allison and Justin Bass, join me today. Justin is currently teaching at Dallas Christian College and at Asian Christian Academy in India. He's author of the book, The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. And in it, he aims to show that there is a surprising amount that both Christians and skeptics can affirm about the historical events surrounding the claims of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Dale Allison is Professor of New Testament Studies at Princeton Theological Seminary. His recent book, The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Criticism, History, looks at how credible apologetic claims about the resurrection of Jesus are given the historical evidence. Now, while Dale affirms that something unusual happened in the first century, he's less certain that we can firmly draw the conclusion that history affirms the bodily resurrection of Jesus. So we'll be asking what kind of evidence can history provide about the resurrection of Jesus. Dale and Justin, welcome along to the show today.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both. Thank you for making time for this special Easter weekend edition of the show. Justin, among the other titles I've already given you, you also do teach at a seminary out in Jordan as well. Do you want to tell us about that? I know you're not currently there this semester, but tell us about your involvement there in the Middle East.
Yes, I felt the Lord call me and my family to move it and sell everything to go to the Middle East. This was in 2017, and we were there from 2017 to early 2020, and COVID basically ended my missionary career. So wow. I actually came back I'm from Texas, and that's where I am now. But I came to Texas to promote my book on the bedrock of Christianity, and planning to go back to Jordan and everything. And then COVID shut everything down, and we waited and waited to be able to go back to Jordan. And 6 months later, you still couldn't go back. They still had it all shut down. And so we believe the Lord was calling us to transition back here. But yes, for 3 years, I was serving there. I'm still adjunct there, teaching online when I'm needed. And but I was a professor of New Testament there at Jordan Evangelical Theological Seminary, JETS for short. Incredible school. Mm. They're training Arabs to reach the Arab world, and really amazing opportunity. Stuff. Yeah, and I had I was working with an NGO, serving refugees there, so had a lot of great opportunities baptizing Muslims in the Jordan River, things like that.
Well, it sounds very exciting, and I hope that you do get the opportunity to go back at some point. I've been myself to the Jordan several years ago now, but it's a beautiful, beautiful place in the world, isn't it?
Inshallah.
Indeed. Before we come to Dale and his background, tell us about just the basic thesis, really, of the book, The Bedrock of Christianity. It came out a couple of years ago now, and I've been intending to have you on the show for ages about it. So I'm glad we've got the opportunity now. But tell us what's basically at the core of this book.
Well, thesis, I could keep it simple. Jesus rose from the dead. Really, I wrote it for a few main reasons. The one I'll highlight here is to just lay out the common ground. Biblical scholars, have disagreed, as Dale knows, on almost everything over the last 250 years of biblical scholarship. But I said almost, not everything. And, to me, it's just fascinating what they do agree on. And so in the book, I call what they agree on mere historical Christianity, alluding to C.S. Lewis's great work, Mere Christianity, where he looks at where do all Christians, whether the Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, where do all Christians agree on? Well, where do all biblical scholars, or do they agree on anything? And I found that they do agree pretty much on Paul. So Paul's early letters, that Paul wrote these letters primarily, the ones I focus on, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, and Romans, that Paul wrote them, certain facts within the letters that he's talking about, his movements, his biography, his conversion, certain creeds and hymns he quotes within the letters go back even earlier than Paul, and then certain facts about Jesus and the earliest disciples in this movement that we call Christianity, but the early Christian movement, emerge from those earliest letters. And again, those, I would say, I think the evidence supports the, I call it bedrock, meaning, there's always some fringe scholars. There's always, some that dispute certain things. But I would say in the high 90th percentile, scholars across the board would agree on these facts. And so the four main facts that emerge from the sources, the bedrock sources, that would be Paul's early letters, would be Jesus' crucifixion. It would be the claim of the resurrection. It would be the appearances of Jesus, namely from the early creed, 1 Corinthians 15, appearance to Peter, appearance to the 12 minus Judas, appearance to more than 500, appearance to James, these multiple appearances recorded there. And then just the rise of the Christian movement. I mean, that's obviously the most undeniable one. But just the rise of the Nazarenes, the rise of these this movement in the early 30s AD in Jerusalem, the same place where Jesus was crucified. So I lay out those bedrock facts, those sources, and in the final chapters, I try to challenge the reader to follow the evidence wherever it leads, even if it leads to strange and scary and wonderful places.
Yeah.
I'll just quote the great line from Shakespeare's Hamlet. I put that throughout the book. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. I just love that. We should expect the extraordinary. We should expect the strange and the wonderful.
Yes, life is often more strange than we ever dreamed. But what is this a sort of version of what's sometimes been called the minimal facts approach to the resurrection? So people like Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona and William Lane Craig have often marshaled what they would say is a kind of consensus scholarly opinion across both believing and non-believing scholars about certain historical facts, or does your approach differ a little from that kind of approach?
Yeah, I would actually call my approach, at least for those first three facts, the minimal approach, because I'm focusing just on Paul's early letters, and some of them, the people you mentioned, you know, they'll include the Gospels and discuss the burial and the empty tomb, but I tried to go where do everyone agree, and that pretty much limited me to Paul. But I would also say that my approach is maybe the most maximal of them all, because of my fourth bedrock fact, because that one is about the rise of the Christian movement and how it went on to, you know, turn the Roman Empire upside down. It went on to become the largest religion in the world. So pretty much all the evidence of Jesus's resurrection that has reverberated throughout the world over the last 2,000 years is included in my approach. So I would say it's the most maximal as well. Right. So I don't know what do you want to call it?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll come back, because I know that both your approach and the approach of others like Craig and Habermas and Lacona have been criticized by some in the Christian church for being minimalist, feeling like that they're discounting an awful lot of the Gospels in sort of trying to find this common ground, as it were, between even the most, you know, skeptical scholars. But we'll maybe come back to that, and let's introduce Dale. Dale, welcome along to the show. Thank you for coming on. I really enjoyed your book. You're very candid at the opening of the book, saying that you sort of have a dual personality, a church-going Christian who says his prayers, but also a hard-headed historian who doesn't want sort of personal faith to get in the way of scholarly rigour. So is that sort of what's been going on when you've been looking into the resurrection, this sort of dual personality of sort of wanting it to be true, maybe, but kind of also having that historical, hard-headed approach?
Sure, although actually... I say at one point that I'm four people, not just two. So I do have these conflicting voices in me. And maybe that's part of the reason why this book doesn't really have a single overarching thesis. It's rather a collection of studies. They're all about the resurrection of Jesus. They're all related to it directly. But I don't start out in chapter one and say, okay, all the arguments will go to show this conclusion. That's not what I'm doing here. What I'm doing, I think, is I'm collecting the standard arguments and a lot of the non-standard arguments that you'll find in the literature written by historians and apologists and skeptics. And by the way, I did a lot of work for this. That is, I read a lot of stuff. I spent a lot of time looking at books and articles that nobody looks at anymore, and I wanted to be fair. And since there's no grand thesis or grand conclusion, I have conclusions, but they're not grand. Let's put it that way. They're not grand. My goal is to contribute to an ongoing discussion, and I have no illusions that anything in my book will slow any of the discussions down at all. But I do have faith that we can improve and that we can refine arguments. I actually would put it this way. I would say Bart Ehrman's skeptical arguments are better than most of the skeptical arguments that came before him, and that Mike Lacona's arguments are, let's say, better than any of the arguments from the 19th century on behalf of the resurrection. So I actually see progress here, and my hope is to contribute to that ongoing discussion. All right. So
And over the years that you've been studying this and, you know, writing about it, and, you know, you've written chapters and now a couple of books at least on the resurrection, has your view changed? Have you moved in either direction personally when it comes to what extent you feel you can historically kind of say, yes, something strange happened? Is there a different part of your personality, let's say the faith part, that sort of simply affirms it's kind of more in a kind of direct faith kind of way?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm embarrassed to say that this book, when compared with what I did in 2005, lines up pretty well with it. It simply adds a lot of material. It discusses a lot of things I didn't before. I wish I could say that I'm so open-minded and I've learned so much that I've changed my mind, but I really haven't. I'm just a little less cryptic, I think, and maybe more learned in that I've read a lot more stuff since then. But the main conclusions are still the same. My main historical conclusions are the same. And actually, I'm not sure that Justin and I are debating partners here. There are things we don't agree on, but in terms of my academic tradition, I'm pretty conservative on all the major historical issues. So I do myself think that there is fiction mixed in with history in the resurrection accounts. However, at the end of the day, I think that somebody named Joseph of Arimathea probably buried Jesus, and I think that his tomb was discovered to be emptied a few days later, and I think that Mary Magdalene had an encounter or believed that she had seen Jesus, and the same thing for Peter and for others. I think all this goes back to the first week. That is, I think belief in Jesus' resurrection goes back to the first week, and that they interpreted this all in eschatological terms. That is, like, to use Paul's phrase, the end of the ages had come. For them, resurrection was the fulfillment of prophecy and so on. Anyway, those are very conservative beliefs given my social location, okay? But they're the conclusions that I have come to. I say at one point they're embarrassingly antediluvian, but there you go, okay?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, though. It, one man's conservative in Princeton is another person's liberal in another part of the U.S., possibly. But it's often a matter of perspective, isn't it? But we'll come back to this, because I'd be fascinated just to chase this up again, perhaps near the end of our conversation, where what this kind of means in practice for you, Dale. But let's jump into some of these bedrock facts themselves, Justin. Perhaps we're going to just try and maybe sketch out four of these facts. There are more, obviously, in the book. And Dale will just sort of interact with them as we go. So do you want to sketch out the first one, which is perhaps, you know, one of the easiest to ascertain, the death by crucifixion of Jesus, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know if there's much Dale would add to that, other than, you know, that this is one of those things that, you know, other than mythicists, you know, other than people that deny that Jesus existed, I don't know of anyone that denies, you know, the fact that Jesus was crucified. Now, exactly when he was crucified is a little bit debated, you know, whether it was 30, whether it was 33. I happen to favor the 33. And if it was 33, then it would have been April 3rd, AD 33, which is incredible. We can get to the exact day. I've been reading a book by Colin Humphreys. I don't know if you've read his book, Dale, on the mysteries of the Last Supper. He's from Cambridge, but he's using astronomical evidence of the fact that there was a lunar eclipse even on April 3rd, AD 33. And so when Peter later on quotes Joel and says, you know, the moon will be blood red, it really was blood red that night, the evening of the crucifixion, which if that's true, that's incredible. That if as Jesus was on the cross, they were looking up at a blood red moon. So this is one of those that there's not much debate, but of course, if there's going to be a resurrection, Jesus had to die.
Dale, what kind of sources, if there were a skeptic, if there were a mythicist among us, would you simply point someone to just for this particular bedrock fact, as it were, the death by crucifixion of Jesus?
Well, I've never found the mythicists persuasive at all. And my take used to be that the notion that Jesus didn't exist was pretty much extinguished by 1910 or 1915, and that there are no really new arguments, that they're all sort of revisions of things we had before, although we do now have Bayes' theorem being employed to show occasionally that Jesus probably didn't exist. But I just don't see how to get around Paul's letters. Paul's letters imply that there's a guy and that he lived recently, and Paul knows people who knew him, and Paul talks about his brother and brothers, and that's just the end of it. I don't see any way to get around Paul, any credible way to get around Paul, just as I don't see any credible way to get around crucifixion. Although I will add that you'll occasionally find the offbeat person say, well, Jesus was crucified, but he didn't die, right? But that is only found, to my knowledge, in really offbeat literature, usually fiction, right? I mean, that plays no role in any serious New Testament scholarship.
And when it comes to this particular fact, do you press beyond Paul, Justin? Do you say that the Gospels themselves can be good historical sort of artifacts for
Of course, yeah. And just, you know, just to be clear, I mean, I think the Gospels, I mean, I hope to write a book, God willing, I'll write a book on the Gospels one day soon as well. I think the Gospels are, you know, full of historical and information and are incredibly accurate in a lot of ways and are, sourced in eyewitness testimony. And so, the reason why I'm sticking with Paul, like I said, is just to get that common ground out there on the table. You know, where does everyone agree? I think that I just find that helpful. You know, Jesus did that with the Sadducees. Paul did it with the philosophers of Athens. Justin Martyr did it with his dialogue with Trypho. John Chrysostom did it with the pagans and the Jews of his day. You know, what's the common ground? What where can we all agree on? And then let's launch from there. So, you know, if I talk to a Jehovah's Witness, for example, I'm going to, you know, use the Gospel of John, and I'm going to ask them, why can't they say what Thomas said, my Lord and my God? So it just depends on, to me, it depends on who you're talking to when it comes to these common ground.
Indeed. The only other sort of major group that I can think of that might have a sort of theological or historical problem with the death of Jesus by crucifixion is Muslims, who obviously there's been a strong strain of belief that Jesus was somehow replaced or, you know, did not actually die on the cross. I remember when I had a similar discussion to this with between Bart Ehrman and Mike Lacona, actually, and Bart was sort of, why do you even need to kind of establish this as a minimal fact? And I did say, well, it might be important for a Muslim to know that Jesus died and so on. And I guess you do need a death to have a resurrection. But let's move on to the next one. Go ahead, Justin.
If I could just say real quickly, you know, on that point, it's fascinating because one of the Muslims who actually do delve into historical Jesus scholarship is Reza Aslan. And Reza Aslan claims to be a Muslim. I don't think his book's very good, but he actually comes to the conclusion historically that Jesus was crucified. So I haven't been able to talk to him how he reconciles that with his belief in the Quran, which denies Jesus' crucifixion. But apparently the facts are so bedrock that, you know, it usurps the Quran itself. So.
Well, let's talk about the next one, which you certainly won't find in the Quran, the unique claim of the resurrection of Jesus. Talk us through this one, Justin, and then we'll have Dale comment on it.
Yeah, so this of course is talked about, but it's usually not emphasized the way I think it should be emphasized. You know, the bedrock fact here is just that the earliest Christians claimed that Jesus was raised from the dead, resurrection. This is the anastasis. This is the language that they were using. They weren't just saying Jesus was exalted to the heavens like the Maccabean martyrs. He was a great martyr. They were using this language that goes back, I would say, you know, maybe even earlier, but at least in Daniel 12, this resurrection that most many Jews at least believed would happen at the end of the age, that the righteous and the wicked would be raised. The early Christians were saying this man Jesus, who was crucified, resurrected like that. That was the beginning of the Daniel type resurrection, and the general resurrection was still to come in the future, as Paul says. Jesus was the first fruits, and then we, when he returns, will all rise again with him. So there's really a threefold innovation here. One, a positive interpretation of crucifixion. That's unparalleled to my knowledge. Everyone looked at crucifixion as a cruel and disgusting punishment, you know, the ultimate, you know, shameful death. But here you have Paul talking about the cross. Christ crucified is the wisdom and the power of God. He wants to know nothing but Jesus and him crucified. You know, where does that come from? And then the second innovation is the resurrection itself. The fact that they're claiming that this man, the Messiah, rose again in the middle of history, and history is now still going to continue. And then we'll have the general resurrection at the end of the world. Again, where do you find that? To my knowledge, there's no expectation for that. There was expectations for a Messiah or Messiahs, But there was no expectation that he would rise again in the middle of history and history would continue on like normal. And then the third point, which is to me is even more amazing, that is that the Messiah who rose again is God in some sense. So he is preexistent. He is. I would say Paul believes he is Yahweh in the flesh. Jesus, this crucified man, is on the same side as the Creator of all things. For these strict monotheists, this is just incredible to me. So Larry Hurtado called this a novel mutation. Yeah, I would say it's a novel mutation. It's a threefold, unparalleled innovation and claim about this man Jesus. And I would say, well, if you don't have a resurrected Jesus, if he stayed dead, where did they get these ideas? And these ideas, of course, have gone on to, change the world. So did they originate in the mind of Mary Magdalene? I mean, is that really where we're going to go? I would say no.
And to the extent that other historians, not necessarily evangelicals, maybe, people of other persuasions, perhaps not Christians at all, do affirm that these claims happened. They're not affirming necessarily that the resurrection happened, but they are saying
exactly
people made claims.
This is what they said.
Paul made claims. The early church made claims.
That's the
and you would say and would affirm that these claims were very unusual. They were not what you would expect Jewish people at that time to be claiming about someone they believed had been the Messiah but got themselves crucified.
Yeah, you don't usually worship crucified men in ancient Israel. That's not
okay.
Normal.
What's your take on this particular bedrock fact, Dale?
Well, I suppose I could quibble here and there. The main point, of course, is that this is not expected, and there are certainly no strong analogies to it. Especially if you're talking about Jewish sources and the language of resurrection. There are a couple of things people can wonder about. So I've always wondered about Mark 6. I don't know what it means. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know how seriously it was taken. But there is the language of resurrection used for John the Baptist. Jesus is John the Baptist, come back from the dead. I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if I should take it seriously. But the problem is it's just sort of off there by itself, right? I also agree with the early high Christology stuff. I've been a proponent of that for a long time.
And by that, do you mean that the claim that Jesus was the Son of God was there very early on in the Christian movement? Is that what you mean?
Yes, I think that's a very early idea. I think preexistence is an early idea. I might be more cautious about some of the literary parallels. So the guy in First Enoch, the Son of Man in the parables of Enoch, is a really interesting character. And if you want to use the term high Christology, there's a sort of high Christology there. So there are these what I would call literary precedents. There's also a Dead Sea Scroll about Melchizedek, which says amazing things about this figure. But you can't find those sorts of things said about an historical person in the recent past. So, as an historian, I'm always allergic to the word unique. I was just trained never to use that because I was taught you don't know enough. Most of history is gone and so on. And I should add that when I was baptized into this field, everybody followed Joachim Jeremias and they said, well, there was no Palestinian Jew that ever addressed God as Abba in a prayer. And it was just something I saw everywhere. But a little Dead Sea Scroll fragment was published, about 30 years ago, and it's a prayer, and there's Abba in it. So that's just, a cautionary note. So I would say unexpected. I would say unprecedented.
Okay. Well, I think we're getting the sense here that you're just wanting to always obviously make clear that you never know what might be turned up historically and so on, Dale, but that in general, on balance, yes, it certainly does seem unusual.
Yes, but you actually both Justins. I can't say Justin and you don't know who I'm talking to. But anyway, you both actually agree the world is filled with very, very, very strange things, right?
Okay.
So anyway, this is one of them. I'll say that. Okay, this is one of them.
Well, look, we're going to go to a quick break. Going to go to a quick break, and we'll come back, you know, on a couple more of these bedrock facts, where I think we might start to see, you know, some different interpretations, possibly where Dale.
We're agreeing too much.
There's a few differences on some of the next couple, but I'll let you respond as well, Justin, in just a moment. We're talking about the resurrection appropriately for Easter here on Unbelievable. Two New Testament scholars, Dale Allison and Justin Bass, join me today, and we're looking at their different approaches to evaluating the evidence, the history around the claims of the resurrection of Jesus. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. Does the historical evidence support the physical resurrection of Jesus? And I think we'll want to talk about the physical element of that in just a moment's time. Today, Dale Allison and Justin Bass, two noted New Testament historians, joining me. Justin's new book is called, well, it's not so new actually, it came out a couple of years ago, but it's called The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. He says there's a lot of surprising stuff, actually, that both Christians and skeptics can agree on historically. The question is, can you point from that towards a miracle like the resurrection? Dale Allison, Professor of New Testament Studies at Princeton Theological Seminary and author of The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Criticism and History, takes a more, you could argue, measured, maybe slightly more conservative view in the sense of not maybe leaping to a physical resurrection. But we'll come to all of that in a moment's time, because we're currently just going through a few of these bedrock facts that you've been laying out for us, Justin. Let's go to the next one. And as you've said, Paul is your primary source. That's because the vast majority of New Testament historians sort of are basically agreed on, you know, the credibility of Paul and the letters and so on. So 1 Corinthians 15, I think, is the key passage that lots of people look to when it comes to what we can know about the claims about Jesus's resurrection through the writings of Paul. So take us through this one.
Yeah, my view is, you know, this is the earliest written, oral, you know, composed a statement of the early Christians that we possess. And you know, I found in the literature, scholars, I really didn't find anybody except a few people that, and they, you know, one of them happened to be a mythicist, but people that would say that it was an interpolation or something like that. But pretty much across the literature, I find of New Testament scholarship that 1 Corinthians 15, that creedal statement that Paul is quoting, goes back within at most the latest 10 years after Jesus's death, and you know, the late James Dunn, he said within months. So a spectrum of within months of Jesus's death to within 10 years of Jesus's death, this creedal statement that Paul quotes and he delivered to the Corinthians, and he had received it sometime before that, that was composed that early, which I find extraordinary. I mean, I think it's the definition of extraordinary.
Can I just read it out, just for those who maybe don't know it immediately? But 1 Corinthians 15, verses 5 to 8 says this. Well, I'll go from verse 3, actually, where it says, "For I handed on to you as of first importance what I in turn had received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers and sisters at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to someone untimely born, he appeared also to me." And the reason why you and other scholars see this as so significant, as you say, is because it's not only in a letter of Paul, which makes it quite early to start right with, but it feels like he's quoting something which has its origins even before that. You say to at least within 10 years of the events that it's claiming. And some, I know, date it right to within a couple of years or even months from the date of the events. So this for you, that, I mean, where would you say, what's kind of, where would you land in terms of its significance yourself, Justin?
I would agree with James Dunn that it was, you know, months. I mean, it just makes sense to me that after the Ascension, after Pentecost, that as the apostles started to go out and proclaim, you know, the death, burial, and resurrection, they would have come up with some kind of memorizable catechism type teaching that was easy to memorize, and then it probably, you know, got, you know, it was a shortened form of the story that, you know, we get in narrative form in the Gospels and the Passion narratives. But, you know, Christ died, so this would have been the story of his sufferings, his trials, his, you know, time under Pilate, crucified under Pilate. He's buried by whom? You know, it's in the passive tense in the creedal statement, buried by Joseph of Arimathea in his tomb. And then he was raised, and then this probably had the, on the third day, so this is maybe a reference to the fact that the women found it, led by Mary Magdalene, found it on the third day, and then he appeared to a number of people, and so we get those same, some of those same appearances at the end of the Gospels. I think they had it was a way to teach the earliest followers, these early, you know, they probably weren't even called Christians then, but maybe they were called the Nazarenes, I don't know what they were called that early, the way, you know, according to Acts, but they, you know, this would have been an easy, memorizable way to have the story in their mind, and then they could probably tell the story in fuller detail from that creedal statement.
And again, not that this proves the resurrection, but what it does show, as far as you're concerned, is that it was there very early. Yeah. The belief that Jesus had raised was being spread, taught in this kind of memorizable fashion from early on, and that requires an explanation for why people started saying and teaching these things. So Dale, how do you read 1 Corinthians 15, and do you see it perhaps as early and as significant as Justin does, or do you have any other perspective on it?
Well, it's certainly significant, and it's also fascinating and provocative. So I have here disagreed with lots of my colleagues about their specificity. So the first thing is that I think all of these traditions here are early, okay? I think they're all early. I actually think that all of them refer to historical experiences, all right? I'm simply not sure whether this creed was originally formulated in, let's say, Antioch, Damascus, Jerusalem. I don't know. I don't know whether originally there was an Aramaic version of this, or this was originally composed in Greek. I can't tell you whether it's AD 34 or AD 39. I'm not sure. But for me, the main point is that the content, whenever it was officially put together, and by the way, I don't know if Justin agrees with this, but I think it grows. That is, in my book, at least the most recent book, I argue that it might have originally ended with the 12, and then we get some material added. Maybe Paul's adding it. Paul certainly adds his own thing at the end. So I don't know. It might grow in two or three stages. That's possible. But at the end of the day, I think the important point is that the experiences back here aren't behind this, they're real. I don't think this is folklore. I don't think this is secondhand. And it is a fact that Paul's talking about himself. He refers to Peter, who's somebody he knows. He's referring to James, somebody he knows. He seems to know something about the 500, whoever they were. And he knows also John, son of Zebedee, and presumably, you know, more than just a couple of the 12. So again, what this shows you is that this belief, and I said this earlier, this belief goes way back, and some of these experiences go way back. Now, I don't know, for example, when the experience to the 500, whatever it was, took place. It might be post-Pentecost, right, for me. In fact, the fact that there is no, probably in my mind, no appearance to James or the 500 in the Gospels is just easily explained if they're later events, right? It's just an easy, straightforward explanation of something somebody wonders about. In any case, I agree with that. Of course, how you explain this, that these people were convinced, or what lies behind those experiences, that's the big question. But I don't think – but I think you'd have to – well, let's just put it this way. I think if you're a skeptic, you're doing yourself a disservice by doubting what's going on here in 1 Corinthians 15:3 through 8. I think it makes more sense if you're a skeptic, which I'm not. It makes more sense to try to explain these things rather than explaining them away and saying, you know, this didn't happen. So we do have a few people who just doubt the appearance to the 500. I don't think they should be doing that, both from my own point of view and from their point of view.
That's interesting to hear you say that, because certainly in this passage, you know, whereas I think because there are resurrection appearances in other sources, such as the Gospels, to some of the people that have been mentioned, whereas this claim of 500 seems to be novel to Paul. And so I have heard skeptics say, well, you can discount that because it's one source. It's just a throwaway line from Paul. You know, how on earth are we to know that whether, you know, it's true or not? But so why do you say you don't think you should dismiss it, Dale?
So I don't know how to argue against a consistent skepticism, because you can doubt anything. But Paul says some of them are still alive. And I just don't see any reason to think that that's a fictional statement. If it were fiction, he might say he appeared to 500. But I'm not sure. I mean, he's really clever if he thinks, oh, I'm going to make this up and I'm going to add that a few of them are still alive. That's just not right. It's like the end of John, where you have the beloved disciple, and some people thought that Jesus was going to come before he died, right? But Jesus didn't say that. The people who think that the beloved disciple is just a literary figure and there's no history behind that, they just can't explain something like that. It makes no sense. There's a real something there. Yeah, I think there's a real something there.
If I could, the ring of truth. Go ahead, Justin.
I agree, and I'll just, you know, add to that point. You know, Paul's credibility is on the line in Corinthians. You know, one of the things he's doing in both 1st and 2nd Corinthians and some of the lost letters of Corinthians is defending his apostleship against these, you know, so-called super apostles, as he calls them. And so he's defending his apostleship. He's you know, he appeals to the fact that he's seen the risen Jesus. This is the direct commission he's been given. So if he appeals to what he says is more than half, basically, are still alive. So we're talking, you know, plus 250. I don't know how he got the exact number, but, you know, clearly it was some kind of estimate. You know, maybe if you had a large crowd, you could say, oh, it's, you know, it's about five. But either way, it's hundreds of people Paul is claiming in the 50s AD, and, you know, when he wrote 1 Corinthians, are readily available to encounter and to discuss the fact that they saw the risen Jesus. That's extraordinary, and I agree with Dale that it has to be at least historical that Paul is telling the truth, because if he was called out for that, you know, this would have completely discredited him. So not to mention the fact that it's in this very early testimony.
Well, let's talk about the nature of these appearances then, because say that we're all on the same page, even with, you know, some skeptical scholars. I mean, I know that people like Gerd Ludemann and others said, you know, it can, you know, it's pretty much beyond doubt that they experienced something that they believed was the resurrected Jesus, be it Peter, James, the apostles mentioned here in 1 Corinthians 15. But the question, of course, remains, well, what was the nature of that experience? Was it a physical flesh and blood Jesus appearing to them? Or was it some kind of hallucination or grief vision or, you know, something else, something that wasn't actually a physical, you know, miracle in that sense? And Dale, I think this is where you've sort of explored the possibilities more, let's say. I know you've done a lot of research into things like hallucination hypotheses and so on. So give us a flavour of what you've learned along the way and maybe where you kind of tend to land when it comes to what the nature of these experiences that the followers of Jesus had.
Okay, so yeah, here I get myself in trouble with some of my fellow Christians, but I guess the way to introduce this is to contrast Luther and Calvin. So Calvin thinks that when Jesus rises from the dead, he has his same physical body, so much so that when he shows up in a room in John 20, Calvin says he went through the door. He didn't walk through the wall. And Calvin actually says that at the ascension, Jesus went to a place. He means a place somewhere in outer space or heaven or up there. Luther thinks that Jesus is in the Eucharist and that Jesus lives within the believer. So for Luther, Jesus is a spiritual presence. In a way, he is not in Calvin. And I think that Jesus is a spiritual presence today. That is, I think he can be present with people when he is not bodily present. And I think that's always been true. And then when I look at the New Testament accounts, I know that Acts calls Paul's vision a vision. And by the way, I need to say here that I much prefer the term, I don't like the term hallucination. Visions, in my mind, can be veridical or non-veridical. That is, visions can involve seeing things that are not physically there in the normal sense, but there is information coming in or reality that you are encountering. And I've tried to hedge my bet in the book. So I say vision or vision-like experiences. And what I mean by that is that Jesus does seem to just pop in out of nowhere. And then he seems sometimes just to disappear, and people don't recognize him, or they have doubts, or they're confused about what's going on. Nobody can follow him when he leaves. He doesn't just walk away. So these sorts of things are vision-like, okay? And so I don't have any trouble being like Pannenberg and saying that these are not exactly the same experiences as me sitting in a room and talking to somebody who's sitting there. Now, I'm open-minded and not dogmatic. What I would say is that these experiences look to me to be vision-like, and I think there are veridical elements. That is, I don't think that they are just hallucinating. But there's also a theological problem here for me, and I just have to admit that when I look at human bodies, they are designed for survival in this world. So does the risen Jesus, if he has his body, does he have intestines? So Gregory of Nyssa thought about this and said, no, he can't. And by the way, Gregory of Nyssa is utterly orthodox, right? He's a saint and Cappadocian father and all that stuff. So he said, well, no, he doesn't have to eat and he's not going to have intestines and so on. And you can do this with everything in the body. Why do you have lungs? So you can breathe air. Does Jesus need to breathe air now? Or, does he have his reproductive organs? Why would he have them? Why would he need them? And so on. Is the whole body sort of redundant in his current state? So I then side with the old Lutheran theologians. Structurally, they would say Jesus rose from the dead and the tomb was empty, and then he entered a new state at some point. Okay? He entered a new state at some point. I just don't have any problems theologically with saying he entered a new state from the beginning. And actually, Martin Luther, in opposing the Calvinists, he said, if you read Gospel of Matthew clearly, the women show up, and then the stone is rolled away, and he's not there. Luther said he went through the wall, or he just dissipated. He doesn't. Whatever it is, he doesn't right. have a body like you or I have it. But Calvin actually thinks he does, right? And there are a lot of theologians in the tradition who think this. So the whole thing puzzles me, but you can see where my doubts are coming
from. I can,
and
it's really helpful just sketching out all of those sort of issues and helpfully kind of puts me a little in the picture that for you it means that a bodily physical resurrection is not necessarily what's implied by the Gospels or by and so on.
Well, look, the early Christians believed that Jesus rose physically from the dead, okay? They did, all right? And I think that the tomb was empty.
Okay? Amen again.
Okay. Okay. But you won't amen this. It just really puzzles me. It just really puzzles me. Okay?
Okay. Justin, where do you want to take it from?
When it comes to the early Christians, I mean, that's who we're talking about. When it comes to Paul, when it comes to you know, the earliest followers of Jesus, I think they definitely believed that it was a bodily resurrection. I mean, you look at the Gospels, I mean, clearly with the tomb empty, that means that something happened to Jesus's corpse, right? I mean, every inch of it, you know, every molecule of Jesus's corpse, something happened. There was some kind of transformation. Now, what exactly is the resurrection body like? I mean, I feel like that's kind of the questions that Paul actually rebukes in 1 Corinthians 15. You know, what a foolish question. You know, why do you ask that question? Well, I think it is fascinating. I agree with Dale that it's fascinating, and we don't know a lot of things about it. It clearly, if our resurrection body is going to be like Jesus's resurrection body, I mean, his body clearly defied physics. It was something extraordinary. It was something strange. Sometimes they didn't recognize him. All those things. But if you just stick with, like I said, Paul and those early statements in 1 Corinthians, I think we could at least say we know he's saying it's a bodily resurrection. And one of the reasons for that is Paul is a Pharisee. This is what, you know, Pharisees definitely believed in bodily resurrection. We know that from Josephus. This is the Danielic type resurrection. You know, many who are asleep in the dust of the earth will rise. This is physical. This is the Maccabean type resurrection. You know, they stick out their arms when they're being persecuted and say, cut off our arms. We'll get them back in the resurrection. You know, that's physical. And so I think Paul and these earliest followers of Jesus, they believed in that kind of physical resurrection. So when they say Jesus rose from the dead, they mean he bodily rose from the dead. And that's what I think happened.
So I agree with that, and I actually have two or three pages where I just gathered together Jewish texts on resurrection, and they are about bodies and flesh and graves and earth. There is only, I think, one possible text where you might have resurrection language used, where it's not that sort of thing. That's in the Book of Jubilees, and the passage isn't perfectly clear. But I would emphasize that I don't think Paul has John Calvin's idea of resurrection. That is, I think Paul believes in a radical transformation. It's bodily, but it's radical. So it's the seed, right? And then the plant, and they're just radically different. So what Paul is trying to do here, I think, is he's trying to stay within the tradition. He wants it to be bodily, and he believes in continuity, but it's almost as though the continuity is as minimal as possible at points. I mean, the seed and the tree. So I think it's a radical transformation. And again, if Luther's right, Jesus can walk through a wall. So if you want to say it's bodily or physical, that's fine. But it's bodily or physical in a way that nothing else we know is bodily or physical. I mean, I don't know anybody who can walk through a wall.
Well, but how many resurrection bodies do you know?
None.
Well,
none.
So if Jesus is the first of that Danielic resurrection that had been prophesied, then this is new creation. I mean, this is something that transcends all things, but it's physical. You know, it goes back to Genesis 1, right? That everything God made was good. And so he's not going to abandon his matter, his physical creation. And so that's why, it's consistent with the testimony from Genesis to Daniel to the early apostles.
Yeah, okay. Well, I would just insist that this is some kind of radical transformation. And you said new creation. So whatever it is, it's not matter.
But
the
it's
way
us.
We understand
but
it
it's our stuff.
Experience.
You wouldn't agree. It's going to be me, but you know.
No. Paul is certainly agreeing that it's you. And if you look at 1 Corinthians, it's the same subject that's experiencing all these things. It's not as though the body is being destroyed or left behind, but I'm insisting that it's a radical transformation. And then if I want to think theologically, and here again, maybe I'll get myself in trouble, but if I read modern science, I just have no idea anymore what matter is. I really don't. when they talk about what this is, they talk about fields of probability and all this truly weird stuff. So we experience matter in a certain way, but when they get to examine it, you know, on a micro level, it's just unintelligible. And I've talked to physicists, and they tell me they don't know what's going on. They don't understand any of this stuff. So what I like best about Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 is at the end he said, well, it's a mystery, right? And I think that's part of the whole chapter. It's not just what he's talking about at the end. This is a mystery. It is part of where part of what he means by we see through a mirror dimly, right? Or, you know, we don't know now. We'll know then. So,
and isn't that a part of the strangeness of the resurrection narratives? You know, the fact that they're so unlike goes back to the expectations, and even like Daniel, you know, they're not shining. You know, Jesus isn't shining like a star. You know, a lot of these, you know, ideas about resurrection, what happens in the resurrection narratives of the Gospels are just, I mean, I love, actually, you know, I think I got this from N.T. Wright, but one of the things I loved that he said is, you know, you notice that they're quoting the Old Testament again and again leading up to the Passion, but then in the resurrection narrative, where are they quoting the Old Testament? You know, they don't say Jesus walked through this wall to fulfill what Isaiah said, you know. So it's like, it's like there's something completely new here that even the prophets didn't see.
Well, so two things. First of all, I have myself adopted Tom's term, transphysicality. And by that, he means physical, but more than physical or something like that. But, you know, we do have this weird thing, and I've never known what to make of it. I just, in the book, I have a little section on it, and I don't do anything with it. But angels appear and disappear, and they can appear real and solid, and I don't have any idea what an angelic nature is. Just none at all. So there's nothing to do with that. It's just, it's strange. It's strange. But I want to underline the strangeness of this and these texts, and I don't like Calvin's attempt to tame them. I don't like Calvin saying that Jesus had to walk through the door, because I don't think that's what the text is saying.
No, I agree. I would say, I love Calvin, but he would be wrong here, you know. I'm with Paul.
And well, okay. And again, I grew up. So here I'm showing my pious past, but I grew up with Jesus lives in my heart, and I like that. And I don't like the notion that he's in outer space, 5,000 miles away, and maybe I'll get to see him someday. That's just weird. That's weird.
Well, I don't think the New Testament says that either. Jesus is clearly pretty close to Paul in the book of Acts when he's in prison.
We're going to take a quick pause, and we'll be back with the final of these bedrock facts, the launching of the Christian movement that has gone on, obviously, to become the largest religion in the world. We'll get Justin to sketch that out. Dale will respond. It's a conversation between two New Testament scholars on the resurrection of Jesus and the historical evidence here on Unbelievable this Easter weekend.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back. We'll return to our conversation between Dale Allison and Justin Bass in just a moment's time. If you enjoy Unbelievable, by the way, we think you'll love Matters of Life and Death. That's our newest podcast from Premier Unbelievable, hosted by bioethicist John Wyatt and his journalist son Tim. Go and check that out. Also, the Ask NT Write Anything show, very popular with Unbelievable listeners. In fact, the latest edition of the show, our Easter week edition of the show, speaks to some of the concerns that are being raised here between Dale Allison and Justin Bass. Tom has his own sort of perspective on Dale Allison's work, which he's been looking at recently. So do go and check that out on podcast as well. The C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, also a listener favourite. The Screwtape Letters is what I'm talking about with Alistair on this week's edition of the Podcaster. So go and check them all out at premierunbelievable.com. Coming up later on, some of your feedback to recent editions of the show. And if you're listening later on this evening here on Premier Christian Radio, Rhys Stephenson is the guest of Emma Fowles. Rhys is a children's TV presenter, and he was a semi-finalist in the most recent Strictly Come Dancing show. He'll be talking about his life and faith with her. On next week's programme here on Unbelievable, it's an interview special. I'll be chatting with well-known apologist Lee Strobel about his new documentary film, The Case for Heaven. It's based on his book, Looking at Evidence for the Afterlife. And we'll be talking about near-death experiences and other phenomena like that. We'll also be previewing some of the sessions and speakers for this year's Unbelievable conference. I'll be introducing you to people like Lisa Fields, Alistair McGrath, Jeff Vine, Sharon Dirickson, some of our other special guests. So look out for that same time next week. And of course, you can get yourself booked in to this year's conference in person or online from anywhere in the world at unbelievable.live. Okay, time to get into the final part of today's discussion. Well, we're returning to the final part of this conversation between my guests Dale Allison and Justin Bass. They're both New Testament scholars. You can find out more about Justin by getting hold of his book, The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. In fact, there's a link with today's show where you can get, I think, a 30% discount. It's at lexhampress.com/bedrock. Again, that's linked with today's show. Dale Allison's book is The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Criticism, History. And I'll make sure to link to Dale's Princeton Theological Seminary page as well, where you'll find links to his books and other works as well. We've been talking about these bedrock facts, the minimal facts, as you've called them, Justin. The one, though, that isn't always included in these sorts of, you know, historical facts sort of is the final one we're going to focus on, the launching of the Christian movement.
The most maximal fact.
in a way, yes. Obviously, it's a historical fact that Christianity became the largest religion in the world. Why do you link it as significant to the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus specifically? Because I guess a lot of scholars would say, well, that's something that happened rather later than these claims, you know, in the, at the very start of the story.
Yeah, what I emphasize, of course, the heart of this, you know, fact is the launching of the movement initially. So that it kind of goes back to that, you know, not only do you have these appearances, these, you know, beliefs that, you know, Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene, Jesus appeared to Peter, he appeared to more than 500, but then you have a movement that starts in the very same place in Jerusalem in the early 30s, where Jesus was crucified and buried, and we agree that the tomb was empty. And in that same place, this movement launches forth. And, you know, it's just like originally it seems, if the book of Acts is telling us the truth, and I think it is, that it's like a sect of Judaism. And like I said, maybe they were called the Nazarenes, and it was a small sect, and it probably, you know, wasn't even that large compared to maybe some of the other, you know, Mithraism and other, you know, mystery religions and other things throughout the second and even into the third century. But eventually, against all odds, this movement then becomes the religion of the Roman Empire. And I just find that you know, that's another just, to me, compelling evidence that, you know, if Jesus rose from the dead, it would make sense to me that he would continue. Not only would his movement continue to endure, but it would also triumph. It would also start to influence, because we know Jesus said, this gospel, the one I'm talking about, this gospel will go to all nations. I mean, Jesus said that. And I don't know if Dale agrees that the historical Jesus said that, but I would say Jesus did say, this gospel will go to all nations. And so if he rose again from the dead and he built his church, I will build my church and the gates of Hades will not overcome it, then what do we find when we look over the last 2,000 years? We find many times where the church could have been destroyed, whether it was by the Caesars in those first three centuries pre-Constantine. They tried really hard. they gave it their best. The rise of Islam was a threat to the church. You know, you could go into the Enlightenment. You could go into communism. I mean, again and again, the church, as G.K. Chesterton said, the church died and rose again because it knew a God who knew its way out of the grave. So I just see that when you look over the last 2,000 years, there's not just one miracle in my mind, but there's many miracles of this movement continually progressing and triumphing. and spanning the globe. I mean, I think, you know, we could see Islam as another world religion that is in many nations, but Christianity, I think, is uniquely the one world religion that has spanned the globe and has captured the hearts and minds in many ways, evangelistically, and just by proclaiming the truth of the gospel and Christ crucified and risen again, and has converts from, you know, every continent on the planet. And so I asked myself, you know, if Jesus rose from the dead, what would the world look like? This world kind of looks like a world where Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, that's kind of my argument for the rise of the Nazarenes. Yeah. But that original the original launching of the movement, I would say, is the core to the argument, because how did this movement get going? I mean, how do you get a movement going when you're dead? That's hard to do.
As a friend of mine puts it, there's a resurrection shaped hole at the beginning of that story. It's a sort of okay. What do you make both of the idea that for this movement to have got going, it needed something like a resurrection to have sparked that, Dale? And then the ongoing triumph of Christianity somehow seems relevant in Justin's view to that what Jesus said would happen did happen, you know, that this will go to the ends of the earth and so on.
Well, I don't know how to do this theoretically, that it's simply a fact that the early Christians did believe this, and it's simply a fact that they were evangelistic, and it's simply a fact that they were successful. I'm cautious about arguing from success. I'm not sure that Justin's actually doing this, but I think if you check the numbers that officially, now I don't know how they count these things, but Christians are, you know, like 2.3 billion or something like that. Muslims are something like 1.9 billion. So if you're just going by the numbers, Islam also has been exceedingly successful, so that you'd have to fill out that argument further. You'd have to ask why Christianity has been successful and why Islam has been successful. I think you would have to do that in order to go forward here. I don't think you're saying, Justin, that that there's truth in numbers, right? I don't think you want to say that.
No.
Okay, because you don't find the truth by counting votes in any circumstance, right?
But specific to just if you want, you know, to help flesh out what I'm saying, specific to the point about Jesus saying the gospel will go to all nations, and even the end of Matthew 28, you know, Jesus says to his disciples what he wants his church to do is to make disciples of all nations. If Jesus rose from the dead and he is the head and we are the body, the church is the body, what is he, according to the New Testament, directing us to do? He's directing us to go and make disciples of all nations. And I see an extraordinary power behind this movement, especially, you know, those first 300 years, to me is where it's most extraordinary. And that's where I think the contrast with Islam really emerges, because from the very beginning of Islam, led by Muhammad himself, they were carrying the sword. They were dominating. When Muhammad died, you know, there were multiple nations already conquered for Islam. There were tens of thousands of followers. When Jesus died, how many nations had he conquered?
Okay, so as well, the answer...
None. So I'm just saying, so it's to me, let me say it this way, and I'll let you speak. Historically, it makes sense to me why Islam continued to triumph. I can't see historically why Christianity, why this movement got going, unless you have something... You agree, extraordinary, but I would say the resurrection of Jesus and then the continued power and guidance behind that to continue its triumph and dominance.
Okay, so here I feel moved to sort of defend the skeptic, okay? So one of the things I do in my book is I try to be fair to both sides. So the question isn't for me, do I find Christianity in many ways wonderful and marvelous, and, you know, do I look at the history of the church and feel a debt to this and that? So of course I do. The most wonderful people in my life, probably without exception, have been Christians, and I think probably my favorite people down through history are Christians also. So I don't want to come across as a skeptic, but a skeptic, I think, can take the minimal fact approach if that's what you want to call it, Justin, and not come to a Christian conclusion. So I don't want to leave the impression that people who disagree with me or have another view are either uninformed or unintelligent. I think that there are informed and intelligent people who haven't come to my conclusion. And I do think that there are skeptical scenarios, or at least a skeptical scenario, that a skeptic could comfort himself or herself with. So, again, I'm not a skeptic, but I think a skeptic could say, well, the tomb was empty, and it was empty because it was robbed, and then they could cite all the evidence for tombs being robbed, and there is a lot of evidence for that in antiquity. And then they could refer to, we talked about visions, so they could take a different view than I do, and they could say, well, yeah, you're right, Allison, it's vision-like, but that's because they were mostly hallucinations. And then, you know, we'd have to talk about that, but they could do that, and they could then say, you know, the early Christians understood this as resurrection because according to, what, Luke 19, when people were going up to Jerusalem with Jesus, some of them thought the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately, and the kingdom of God is resurrection. So I can see a skeptic saying, you know what, I'll buy all your minimal facts, and I'm then going to interpret them according to my worldview. Okay, and my worldview is that there is no God, there is no creator, miracles are impossible. So as unlikely, for example, as a robbery of a tomb would be, and there's no proof from it, I think it's more likely than somebody rising from the dead. So when I finished this book, one of the things I thought was, well, the resurrection makes sense for me within my Christian framework, but I don't see it as a sort of isolated fact that generates a worldview. I rather see a bunch of historical facts that we have, and that the worldview can configure this. And as a matter of fact, that's what happens. Now, whether it should, but as a matter of just fact, that is what happens to people, and to people I know, and to people I read, and so on. And I'm not comfortable just saying that they're all either uninformed, or that they're, you know, they're just stupid, that they can't see things. So I think that the evidence is consistent with the Christian claim, but I don't think so. Here's probably where we differ. I don't think it forces you to change your worldview. In other words, I think you can look at it as a skeptic and say, no, I'm not going to go there. Okay?
Yeah. Justin, go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say force is the wrong word. I would use the word compel, though. I do think that the evidence is compelling. I think it points, as Dale has said, I think he says this somewhere in his book, he agrees that the evidence points to something extraordinary. So really, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm saying, here are the facts. Everyone agrees on the facts. They point towards, I think, the evidence is compelling that it shows the risen Jesus. But this evidence, follow it where it leads, and you know, look into it. You know, so I'm challenging the skeptic to really go into it. Just a point I wanted to make on what Dale was saying about, you know, they could come up with another alternative, you know, explanation. I'd love to hear it again, because I think I've heard Dale say, I listened to a few of your interviews recently, and you said that, you know, all the alternative explanations that you've heard given to explain these type of facts, all the alternative explanations you think fail, correct? And if anyone's read them all, you have. So I just wanted to hear that again.
Okay, so I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. So what I say in the book is that I don't find any of the stories I have read compelling. All right.
Yeah.
I think that they are bad stories. And there that's I agree right. with Mike Lacona. That's a contribution of his book. He's looked at all these alternative scenarios. So I said, trying to be fair, can I come up with a better one that Mike hasn't wrecked? And right. I just gave you a summary of that. And right. if you want to say there's no evidence for it, well, from one point of view, yeah, there's no compelling evidence for it. But again, if you view the world through a certain lens, if miracles are impossible and there is no God, you can look at the history of religions and say, well, people see Krishna, people see Mary, and you think they're hallucinating. And you can make these moves, and they seem natural to you. They don't feel weird. They just seem obvious. Of course they hallucinated, and of course the body must have been stolen. And
let's assume for a moment that the scenario that you came up with just as you wrote your book in 2021, let's assume that that one also isn't convincing to most. That would then leave right, the resurrection hypothesis as the
the problem, Justin, is that you're a Christian and you believe in God and miracles are kind of easy for you. But if you don't start there, what I'm trying to say is that if you don't start there, or if you're not truly open-minded, sort of adrift or looking for something, if you have a firm worldview in place, it is going to interpret the facts for you, and you're not going to feel these in the way you do. That is, as a theist and somebody who's open to miracles and somebody who has benefited from the Christian tradition, you're going to look at this and say, yeah, it makes perfect sense. I'm simply trying to understand people who actually aren't me. I'm trying to understand them, and they can read my book or they can read your book, and they can say, whatever the explanation, no. And I don't think they're all unintelligent or uninformed.
Well, I'm not saying they're unintelligent, but just, you know, on that point, just real quickly, if Sam Harris, let's say Sam Harris, you know, the well-known atheist, if he, you know, with you looked at all those possible alternative explanations for the resurrection, and like I said, other than the one that you brought up that you think, you know, could be a possible one, if he looked at all those and all of those were not convincing, then you have the resurrection hypothesis. That's what I'm saying. I mean, how is that not following the evidence where it leads?
There is a possibility here, and it's something that I do in my book. There are historical events that for which I have no explanation, and I don't accept the religious explanation. So there's a whole chapter in my book on an event that took place or a series of events in Zaytun, Egypt in 1968. And these are appearances of Mary. And there were tens of thousands of people who saw this, secular, Muslim, Christian. And I've read the accounts. I've looked at the pictures. I've talked to people involved. And I look at this, and the Coptic Christian will say, this is Mary, and you just can't see what's obvious. And I look at it, and I say, I don't know what the heck this is. I have no explanation, but I'm not ready to bet that it's Mary. So there's also that option, Justin, that is of looking at this and saying, you know what, Justin, I don't really have a good alternative scenario, but I prefer agnosticism because I'm just not willing to go there, right? And that's not totally unreasonable, because I think it's the case for some things I've confronted as an historian. I don't know what to do with them.
And I do lay out that third option in my book as a, you know, cautious agnosticism. You know, E.P. Sanders, I love what he says at the end of Jesus and Judaism. You know, he basically says, he lays out, you know, I know this happened. You know, there was an empty tomb, the appearances, all this. What happened? What led to this movement that, you know, has launched? You know, he says, I don't know. But my challenge is to not stay there. But just on those parallels, I just wanted to bring up, you know, one thing that I was fascinated with, and I enjoyed, you know, reading through Dale's parallels in the book that he brings up. But what one thing that I found fascinating was pretty much all the parallels are within the Christian worldview. I mean, they're all within Christendom. Yes, I know.
There's one chapter.
Well, yeah, the rainbow bodies. I know that, but the, other than that, I mean, because like when you talk about Paul, you bring up, you know, Sundar Singh,
yes,
who is a Hindu who was fighting against Christians, who was burning Bibles, persecuting Christians, and he has an appearance of Jesus, and he becomes this incredible missionary for Christianity. You know, a lot of Christians might have heard of him. And, you know, to me, like I'm saying, that this goes along with my fourth, my bedrock fact, the fourth one. If Jesus rose from the dead and he appeared to all those people back then, it only makes sense to me if he wants the gospel to go to all nations, if he's still seeking the lost like he was when he was on earth. He's saving people like, Sundar. He did appear to Sundar Singh. I mean, because that just supports to me the resurrection.
I get the sense as well, Justin, that perhaps the fact that you for a long time have lived and ministered and taught in the Middle East, where there are some pretty amazing stories of Muslims coming to faith through dreams and visions and everything else, this perhaps puts you a bit more into the frame of not just being a sort of historian just looking at the facts, but thinking, yeah, weird things happen because I hear about them from my students and so on, right?
That's exactly right. And this was a new argument that I have been using ever since I've been in the Middle East, because I've met and personally talked to multiple Muslims who have become Christians because they believe that Jesus appeared to them. And these were people that were from Iraq, people from Syria, people from multiple different places having independent accounts that are very similar. You know, they would see this body of light. It was white. He would quote, you know, usually speak like what we hear Jesus say in the Gospel of John. Some of them had never even read the New Testament before. And so here's a question, you know, just to throw out, you know, why don't Christians ever have visions of Muhammad? And why don't Hindus have visions of Muhammad? Why don't Muslims have visions of Joseph Smith and then say, oh, you know, Mormonism is true? You know, I've really actually searched these things on YouTube, on Google. I can't find, I've never seen it in the literature, but you do have Jesus appearing to people of all different walks, of different religions. To me, that says maybe there's something to Jesus and there's not something to these other faiths.
We'll have to start to wrap it up here. So let's start to get some final thoughts from you, Dale. But I'm getting the sense that, again, this is pressing into what you've already said, which is you do feel that Justin's coming from a very different place to the naturalist, the skeptic, the Sam Harris, and that's obviously going to color the way what he's willing to accept as an interpretation of the historical facts.
Let me just add, though, I have a chapter in my book on post-New Testament visions of Jesus, and if you read it carefully, I am not dismissive, and I in fact think that this visionary literature, these encounters, need to be studied more carefully and more critically, and we need to learn from them. So I am not an expert. I'm familiar with some of these stories about Muslims having visions of Jesus and so on, but I'm not firsthand, I'm no expert on that. But I've just said, and of course this is embarrassing in some scholarly context, but I have said, if Jesus showed up once in a while, you know, to people in the New Testament, why can't he do that today?
And he seems to be. Nabil Qureshi, was he on your show before, Justin?
Yeah, I've had Nabil on before. He sadly passed away, obviously, a few years ago. But again, interesting journey there. Someone who, it was actually the minimal facts that got him first, because it was when someone showed him that the evidence for Jesus' crucifixion was sort of insurmountable that kind of started to make him question his Muslim faith, and then the dreams followed, as it were. This has been a fascinating discussion between you both. Thank you. I'm sorry that time has run out and we can't pursue it any further, but I've really enjoyed the very gracious way in which you both interacted with each other, both in the areas where there's obviously a lot of agreement and also in the areas where there's a difference about the way things can necessarily be interpreted. But again, I will recommend both the books if you want to dive deep into this. Justin's book is The Bedrock of Christianity. It's linked from today's show. You can get a discount as well from the link that we're providing today. Dale Allison's Jesus book is The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Christianism, History. Again, links to Dale's page as well. But Justin and Dale, thank you so much for being with me on today's show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed today's discussion, and I hope you can get in touch as well if you've got thoughts about it. Email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can leave your thoughts when we post this show to our Facebook page as well, facebook.com/premierunbelievable, or at the YouTube channel where today's show is available as a video as well. You can also text me, tweet me, @unbelievablejb on Twitter. Would be great to hear what you made of today's programme. We've not got too much time, actually, for your feedback, and I've had loads of feedback to Glenn Scrivener and Bart Ehrman debating whether Christianity made us moral. Let's just squeeze in one piece of feedback, though, before we love you and leave you. Lauren says, "Dear Unbelievable, I'm an American Christian who just discovered your program last year. I can hardly get enough of it and recommend it to just about anyone who'll listen. Being able to access these kinds of challenging and spiritually enriching discussions is such a privilege, and I hope your whole team knows how much their work is appreciated. Especially fascinating were two recent episodes on India's caste system and the religious aspects of the war in Ukraine. Also in this category would be the special episode last year featuring Richmond Wandera. I can't be the only one who's eager to hear more episodes of this type, i.e. those that provide insight into the experiences of Christians beyond the West, namely the US, Canada, Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. I know this may not be the prerogative of this programme. I understand that guests from the West may be more familiar and have more to offer of direct relevance to what I assume is a primarily Western audience. However, as someone whose faith was strengthened by witnessing Christianity in a different cultural context, I believe that learning about how other cultures approach belief and unbelief is another helpful approach to evaluating our own worldview. Our conclusions regarding the nature of life, however purely rational we may think them to be, are also shaped by our lived experience. We may see relative peace all around us in the US and conclude even subconsciously that humans are fundamentally good. But do others draw the same conclusion while living under failed states and deeply corrupt regimes? All of us have cultural blind spots that only come to light when thrust into a different context, in which what we find so familiar as to be invisible is regarded as bizarre or even sinful, and vice versa. Additionally, with the number of Christians in the global south rising even as those in the global north continue to decline, it's worth examining the explanations offered for this on both sides of the belief fence. And that's just for a start. There are many topics that could be explored with Christian and non-Christian guests from outside our Western bubble. As I know you're aware, and I wanted to get my vote in case you're considering this direction, it may not completely revolutionise our Western way of thinking about faith and religion, but at a minimum, it would challenge us to reevaluate it, as all the great episodes of this programme do. Thanks again, and may God continue to bring forth more and more fruit from the work that you do. Lauren, bless you, and I couldn't agree more. I think we do sometimes have a very Western bubble-focused sort of way of looking at Christianity, and admittedly, the vast majority of those who listen to Unbelievable on podcast and video are in the Western Hemisphere. But the Global South is an important place, and Christianity is growing in leaps and bounds, as you say, and we would like to include more of those global voices. In fact, we very much want to bring a global perspective to the Unbelievable Conference this year. That's why we've got guests both from the US, Canada, UK, but also our friend Joseph D'Souza from India is going to be with us. And we'll certainly be hearing from more of those global voices as we continue to put out new shows, videos and podcasts from Premier Unbelievable in the coming years. So I do encourage you, if you want to be part of that and to see the big launch of Premier Unbelievable, Saturday the 14th of May at the British Library or online from anywhere in the world is the place to be. Really looking forward to the launch of what we are considering a truly global ministry, not just a Western ministry. Unbelievable.live is the place to go. Great to hear from you, Lauren, though. Thanks for emailing in. And let me tell you what's coming up next time. It's an interview special next week. I'll be chatting with well-known apologist Lee Strobel about his new documentary film, The Case for Heaven. It's all based on his book, looking at evidence for the afterlife, as we talk about near-death experiences and other phenomena. We'll also be previewing some of the sessions and speakers for this year's Unbelievable Conference, introducing you to people like Lisa Fields, Jeff Vines, Sharon Dirks, Alistair McGrath, and some of our other special guests. That's all coming up next time. For now, thank you for being with us, and I wish you a very happy Resurrection Sunday.